So last week, we spent a little bit of time. We started out looking at the oath, the agreement that Israel had made with the Gibeonites, the Canaanites, and it was an agreement that let them live. And I'm sure we remember it was based on Gibeonite deception. Oh, we're from a ways away, and you know, all this distance and travel, and the Israelites didn't bother checking with Yahweh, and they made an agreement that they would let them live. And the result was that the Gibeonites became slaves of the Israelites, and they were water and wood bearers. And that fits Noah's prophecy or curse combined that he placed on Canaan's offspring, that they would be servants or slaves to particularly the people of Seth, which is the lineage that takes us down through Abraham's children here. And so after spending some time with that, we went on with chapter 10, and we saw some kings of Jerusalem. The king of Jerusalem led the kings of Hebron, Jarmuth, Lachish, and Eglon to attack Gibeon. And they did that out of fear. That was their motivation. They knew that Jericho and Ai had been destroyed, and then now that there's a covenant with Gibeon, which was a large city, that made one of the groups that they thought might help protect them from these Israelites marching around that had taken a few cities. Instead of being protectorates, now they're allies or included in the Israelite nation and have a treaty with them. And so the kings from these cities, it was in the southern part of the country, the hill country, they came up and attacked Gibeon. And of course, the people of Gibeon quickly appealed to Joshua and said, basically, don't forsake your slaves. Here we are, we're being attacked. And so Joshua brings up the warriors from Gilgal, and Yahweh tells them to have no fear. He tells Joshua, I've given them into your hands. Not one of them will stand against you. And so Joshua arrives with a certain amount of suddenness. It was a night march, but it wasn't as much their surprise attack as Yahweh's action. The Bible tells us that Yahweh himself confounded those kings that were attacking. And Yahweh himself was more destructive than Joshua and his troops. Yahweh threw hailstones at them, and more died from the hailstones than those that were killed by the warriors. Now, I'm using the term hailstones. That's really hail slash stones. When you go back to the word that's listed there, that word is used sometimes to describe hail of ice, like we would say hailstones. But that word is often used of actual stones and marble and some of those kinds of stones in specific. And it's used more that way than as the ice-type hailstones. Whether it was ice or whether it was rocks that rained down from the heavens, God was still the primary one carrying out the battle, and through his efforts on fighting on behalf of Israel in that way, more died from the hail than from the soldiers protecting. And then Joshua goes to Yahweh and says, you know, I need some help, essentially. Would you please have the sun and the moon stand still at Gibeon? This day's going to be over and we're not going to have all of our work done. And it says that Yahweh heard him and that Yahweh fought for Israel. And a part of that is the sun and the moon did not move for about a day. So probably, I don't know how a day in this context meant the daylight hours. So it doubled the daylight hours of that day. And indeed, they were being successful. Joshua heads back to Gilgal. The five kings at a community called Makkedah find a cave and hole up there. And Joshua says, put stones on the door and guard it, but don't stop fighting. Keep pursuing the armies. And they did. And they continues to do that until they had been successful in putting everyone to death except for some survivors that made it back to the cities. And so Joshua gathers the people at Makkedah, where the cave is. Joshua says, bring out the kings. He instructs the chiefs to put their foot on their necks. He says, be strong and courageous. Yahweh will do so and take care of all of our enemies in the days ahead. In like manner, the kings were put to death. They were hanged on trees until evening, and then they were sealed up in the cave for as their grave site. And the writer said it happens, and it's still like that to this day. So Joshua and the army captured Makkedah, the community as well. And the king of Makkedah, who was not part of the five, and all the people in the community were utterly destroyed. The Bible says, just like Jericho. Which brings us to chapter 10, verse 29. And that's where we're going to start today, working through the scriptures. So let me read 29 through 43, which is the end of the chapter. Then Joshua and all Israel with him passed on from Makkedah to Libnah and fought against Libnah. The Lord gave it also with its king into the hands of Israel, and he struck it and every person who was in it with the edge of the sword. He left no survivor in it. Thus he did to its king just as he had done at the king of Jericho. And Joshua and all Israel with him passed on from Libnah to Lachish, and they camped by it and fought against it. The Lord gave Lachish into the hands of Israel, and he captured it on the second day and struck it and every person who was in it with the edge of the sword, according to all that he had done to Libnah. Then Horam, king of Gezer, came up to Lachish, and Joshua defeated him and all his people until he had left him no survivors. And Joshua and all Israel with him passed from Lachish to Eglon, and they camped by it and fought against it. And they captured it on that day and struck it with the edge of the sword, and he utterly destroyed that day every person who was in it, according to all that he had done in Lachish. Then Joshua and all Israel with him went up from Eglon to Hebron, and they fought against it. They captured it and struck it and its king and all of its cities and all the persons who were in it with the edge of the sword. He left no survivor, according to all that he had done to Eglon, and he utterly destroyed it, and every person was in it. Then Joshua and all Israel with him returned to Debir, and they fought against it. He captured it and its king and all its cities, and they struck them with the edge of the sword and utterly destroyed every person who was in it. He left no survivor, just as he had done to Hebron. So he did to Debir and its king, and as he had also done to Libnah and its king. Thus Joshua struck all the land, the hill country and the Negev and the lowlands and the slopes, and all their kings. He left no survivor, but he utterly destroyed all who breathed, just as the Lord, the God of Israel, had commanded. Joshua struck them from Kadesh Barnea, even as far as Gaza, and all the country of Goshen, even as far as Gibeon. Joshua captured all these kings and all their lands at one time, because the Lord, the God of Israel, fought for Israel. So Joshua and all Israel with him returned to the camp at Gilgal. So once the defeat of the five kings is complete, as well as Makkedah, next they go on to Libnah, and they bring its defeat. And then they go to Lachish, and they camped by it and did battle. And on that, it took 2 days, but they were successful, and they struck all down. And then Horam, the king of Gezer, came to Lachish, and Joshua defeated him and his people and left no survivors. And you can see the pattern that's going, and all of these happened very quickly. Went on to Eglon. There they camped and fought, and they captured on that day that kingdom or that city. And so it's on that day. These are 1 day and occasionally 2 day battles. And from Eglon, they go to Hebron. They capture all of its cities. Notice that one's a little different. Whoever was the leader of the Hebron area, it was more of an area because it was multiple cities. But once again, no survivors. Then they went to Debir, and they did battle, and they captured their cities. Once again, plural, and no survivors. And we come down in verse 40 to kind of a summary statement. All the land and the hill country, the Negev, the lowland, the slopes, and all the kings, he overcame them. There were no survivors. And he utterly destroyed all who breathed, just as, and this is extremely important, Yahweh, the God of Israel, had commanded. And verse 41, it talks about how Kadesh Barnea was a central point for a while. And from there, he captured all of the Gaza area and the country of Goshen as far as Gibeon. Now, when we run into Goshen, we that's an interesting term, right? Where's Goshen? Well, the one back in the Exodus book is in Egypt. This particular area they called the Goshen area. Why, I don't know. But it actually covered country generally between the area of Gaza and Gibeon. So we're down in southern Israel. We're not clear down to Egypt. They did not go back to Egypt and take part of Egypt here. But they fought in that area and took that as well. And so this is what God had commanded them to do. And God had commanded them to leave no survivors. This is a part of God exercising his judgment on the land of Canaan. It wasn't that God was trying to tell them the right way to be is this kind of ruthless. It isn't that that's the kind of people he wanted them to be in every turn, but that they were fulfilling a mission, a judgment of God upon the people, and this is what God had allotted to happen. In verse 42, it says this, Joshua captured all these cities and their lands at one time. Why did that occur? Read the rest of the verse. What's the cause that's mentioned there in chapter 10, verse 42?
God fought for Israel.
God fought for Israel. We got a very graphic example of that in the previous lesson, still in this chapter, but previous lesson time-wise to us, when God fought with the hailstones, with the stones slash hail, whatever they might have been. God was more destructive than Joshua and the armies. And so God is here, he's being a part of that, and he has gone with them and made them successful. God himself is fighting on behalf of the Israelites. In verse 43, we see that Joshua and all of Israel returned to Gilgal. Essentially, all of southern Canaan has now been taken. If we had the map, not the one I handed out today, but the one previously that we were looking at. Let's see if I've got it real close. The one that looked like this, it starts with their activity just above the Dead Sea. And what Joshua has done is moved to the west and the south. And for all practical purposes, maybe very specifically, I'm not sure which, but he has captured the southern part of Israel from Bethel south. And they've completed that very quickly. The kings, it started with a group of kings that were concerned, and they came down and attacked at Gibeon. And as they attacked at Gibeon, what they actually were doing was making it more convenient for Joshua to take these kings and put them out, as well as the people, and capture these cities very quickly. Now, obviously, God is the main mover and player. We saw what happened a few lessons ago when they went up and tried to do Ai out of their own plan and their own might. They were run off. That didn't work. But when they had God with them, they were able to move quickly. And so these kings came down and they attacked Gibeon. That was in last week's lesson. And Joshua defeated them quickly. And then he just started going town by town by town and taking the city or cities as the case may be, and very quickly has now taken all of southern Israel, what will be their nation in that area. Questions, comments, thoughts? Okay. Well, let's go on then and begin with chapter 11. Now, that today is going to apply to the map that I put out there that you could pick up on your way in, looking something like this. I've got two of them here, but looking something like this. And I'll try to point out the towns that are on this map that help us get some reference to where are they at that particular moment. I will quickly tell you that when you look at that map, you'll see some question marks. And one in particular, for example, there at Madon, off to the east of the Sea of Galilee. Clearly this map is on the northern part, but Mermon's got a question mark. Ashphath has a question mark. Ashphath has a question mark. And probably some of the others ought to have question marks. Tyre and Sidon we're pretty sure about, but some of the rest, we're doing our best to piece together where these towns likely were. So first of all, let's look at Joshua chapter 11, and I'm going to read the first 15 verses. Then it came about, when Jabin, king of Hazor, heard of it, that he sent to Joab, king of Madon, and said to the king of Shimron, and to the king of Ashaph, and to the kings who were of the north in the hill country, and in the Arabah, south of Chinneroth, and in the lowland, and on the heights of Dor on the west, to the Canaanite on the east and on the west, and the Amorite, and the Hittite, and the Perizzite, and the Jebusite in the hill country, and the Hivite, and at the foot of Hermon in the land of Mizpah. And they came out, and they all, with all their armies with them, as many people as is the sand on the seashore, with very many horses and chariots. So all of these kings, having agreed to meet, came and encamped together at the waters of Merom to fight against Israel. Then the Lord said to Joshua, "Don't be afraid because of them, for tomorrow at this time I will deliver all of them slain before Israel. You shall hamstring their horses and burn their chariots with fire." So Joshua and all the people of war with him came upon them suddenly by the waters of Merom and attacked them. The Lord delivered them into the hand of Israel, so that they defeated them and pursued them as far as Great Sidon and Misrepoth Maim, and the valley of Mizpah to the east, and they struck them until no survivor was left to them. Joshua did to them just as the Lord had told him. He hamstrung their horses and burned their chariots with fire. Then Joshua turned back at that time and captured Hazor, and struck its king with the sword, for Hazor formerly was the head of all these kingdoms. They struck every person who was in it with the edge of the sword, utterly destroying them, and there was no one left who breathed, and he burned Hazor with fire. Joshua captured all the cities of these kings and all their kings, and he struck them with the edge of the sword and utterly destroyed them, just as Moses, the servant of the Lord, had commanded. However, Israel did not burn any cities that stood on their mounds, except Hazor alone, which Joshua burned. All the spoil of these cities and the cattle and the sons of Israel took as their plunder. But they struck every man with the edge of the sword until they had destroyed them. They left no one who breathed. Just as the Lord had commanded Moses his servant, so Moses commanded Joshua, and so Joshua did. And he left nothing undone of all that the Lord had commanded Moses. All right. So this is the bulk of the northern conquest that we just read. And the king of Hazor heard of what happened in the southern conquest. And in that southern conquest, what happened? Well, that was a complete defeat of the southern area of Canaan. The reputation, the the details about what Joshua and the Israelites are doing with Yahweh fighting on their side has grown significantly. They took cities a day at a time, 2 days at a time, and they were very successful, and they were wiping everybody out, and they were just unbeatable. And so the king of Hazor hears about all of this, and he takes action. Obviously, he had concern, fear, and he sends to the kings of Madon, Shimron, Ashaph, the kings of the North Hill country, not quite sure what all that covered. They were in Arabah, that's not listed, but south of Chinneroth, the lowland, the heights of Dor on the west. And so he has sent out to quite a number of people, but verse 3 gives us some people groups he included as well. The Canaanite on the east and west, the Amorite, the Hittite, the Perizzite, the Jebusite, particularly in the hill country, and the Hivite at the foot of Hermon, the land of Mizpah. And so this is an all hands on deck for the kings and their armies of the northern kingdom. But let's take a look at just what his communication has done. First of all, let's just go back to the map for a moment, and you can find Hazor. Hazor is down here in between the Sea of Galilee and that northern little chunk of water up by Kadesh. It's one of the ones that has the block of words out to the side. And so the king of Hazor is the one that leads this effort. And then you can also find Madon, that's clear down by the Sea of Galilee. Now, we were down around the Dead Sea, so we're north of where we were, obviously, in the previous map. This map's further north, but Madon's down there just to the west of the Sea of Galilee. And so that's one that he sends to. He also sends to Shimron, which is a little bit south, but mostly west of Madon. And then he has Ashpath, which is north and west of Madon, and even eventually gets down to Dor on the west, as well as kings in the hill country. And then he also then sends out by people group in verse 3. And I want us to go to Exodus chapter 34, verse 11. We could go to a number of places to read this, but this one's as good as any. And what's going on in Exodus chapter 34 is it's a moment after the golden calf and the destruction of the tablets of stone, the first set. Another set has been made, and the covenant is being renewed between God and the Israelites following their worship of the golden calf as led by Aaron, while Moses is up on the mountain. And in the midst of the re-establishment of the covenant between Israel and God, it says this in verse 11. Be sure to observe what I'm commanding you this day. Behold, I'm going to drive out the Amorite before you, and the Canaanite, the Hittite, the Perizzite, the Hivite, and the Jebusite. And he goes on to say, watch yourself that you make no covenant with the inhabitants of the land into which you are going, or it will become a snare in your midst. And then he gives some instructions about tearing down their altars and so on. It's interesting if you look at that list and the list of what this northern king did in terms of who he contacts, it's almost exactly the same list. The Canaanite, the Amorite, the Hittite, the Perizzite, the Jebusite, and the Hivite. And so God has been consistent in talking about taking out these people before them. And so God says that he's going to do that. And so here we have all of these armies gathering together from the northern kingdom, and they are ready, planning to do battle with Joshua. In verse 4, it says that their numbers are like the sand on the seashore. And he mentions many horses and chariots. Where have we run into horses and chariots before with regard to the Israelites? The Egyptians chased them, and they had horses and chariots. I think we've talked about this, but we will talk about it now if we haven't. Did the Israelites have horses and chariots? No, they didn't have them back when Egypt was chasing them, and they don't have them now. Horses and chariots were going to come along in their military hardware, if you will, their military equipment much later. And so at this point, they're not horses and chariots kind of an army. They're foot soldiers, and so far, horses and chariots haven't come up. But here are these folks in the north, and this is the technical art of the warrior business in that day was the horses and chariots. So when we look at what the king of Hazor is able to pull together, we have so many soldiers we don't even get a count on them because they're like the sand of the seashore. We have horses and chariots there, which now they've got better weapons to be dealing with the Israelites. And they're all gathered up at the waters of Merom. And I don't know if I pointed that out on the map, but it's up there just west of Kadesh. And so these armies are all there in the course of getting ready to fight Israel. Now, we don't know what their intentions were. Were they going to take some defensive posture anticipating the Israelite army to come up to attack them? Or were they going to then put themselves together as an offensive attack group and go down and seek out Israel and Joshua and the armies that God is fighting on behalf of? Don't know, but we know what happens. What actually happens is Yahweh, in the midst of this information, comes to Joshua, "Don't be afraid of them. Tomorrow at this time, they're going to all be slain before you." And God takes credit for, "I'm going to deliver them to you slain." And God's instructions are not to capture their weapons of war, but hamstring their horses and burn the chariots with fire. What does it mean to hamstring a horse? Not a pleasant thing to think about. What? Yeah, essentially it's cutting the Achilles tendon, and so they're not able to really do much. I don't know how. I know that it's devastating in terms of the horse doing anything for mankind in any way. I don't know if the horse is still able to get around and graze or what the limitations really are, but they're essentially eliminating the horses as potential future military helpers for anybody, including themselves. And they're going to burn the chariots with fire. So they're going to do away with these weapons of war that are in that category. So Joshua, following God's direction, "Don't be fearful. Don't be afraid. I'm going to deliver them slain before you tomorrow." Joshua and the warriors once again arrive and surprise the opposing armies at the waters of Merom. So they're gathering. Don't know how prepared they were, but there they were for the purpose of preparing to fight Israel. And in verse 8 it says, "Yahweh delivered them to Israel." He defeated them. And it's the military term would be a rout. It was a rout. And the Israelites now are pursuing these wildly retreating soldiers who are running away as their best as they can. And they pursued them as far as the Great Sidon. And we see the community of Sidon up there at the very northern part of our map, which shows a long pursuit. Now, keep in mind, Israel's about the size of New Jersey, so it wasn't like some of the land masses that we might have looked at. But they also go to the Valley of Mizpah to the east, which we're not sure where that is. There's many people believe that when we talk about up to the Great Sidon, that Sidon was on the southern part of a mountainous area up there that had a great valley just to the north of it, and it would be in that plain up there that they think was often referred to as the Great Sidon. But the Israelites chase them basically as far north as Sidon and as far east as the Mediterranean. I'm sorry, as far west as the Mediterranean. And they continue in this until there are no survivors. So once again, God has been very, very faithful to the Israelites to fight on their behalf. And then in verse 9, just as commanded by Yahweh, the horses are hamstrung, their chariots are burned, and so now Joshua and company turn back, and they go to Hazar. So they've defeated all these armies and the kings, and they go to Hazar, and they find the king of Hazar, and he is killed. And there's a statement there that feels more like the political times we live in now. It says he was the king really of all these regions. So when Hazar is calling out these armies, he's not doing it just as, hey, I'm over here in Hazar and I think this is bad. What do you think? Why don't you come join me? He is the leader of that whole northern region. And so he has a lot of pull. And so Joshua stops and focuses on Hazar. And he goes back and defeats that king and the people. And all of the people are killed, none left. And then Hazar itself is burned. And that takes us through verse 11. And I'll just kind of pause for a minute. Questions, comments, thoughts? Yes. They can't stand anymore, even? Okay.
That way. But then we also talked about the fact that God had them do that so that they would rely upon him and not on the military
mind. Yeah, I mean, and that's a good point, because what do the Israelites have that are making them so successful? And you could tell that early on they believed it was the numbers of people. Because when they looked at taking AI and they evaluated fighting with AI on that basis, they went, oh, there's not that many people. We only need 2,000 or 3,000 soldiers. And they quickly found out their strength was not in their people. Their strength was in the blessing of God and his fighting on their side and fighting on their behalf under his direction. And so they found that out, and that is the real power. And that's a good point. It's easy to say those things, and I agree with them entirely. We're not exactly fully given the mind of God, but I think that's a very reasonable insight into why would God have them destroy those chariots and the horses, other than you're going to stay reliant on me and my power to continue to do what we're doing. What else? Well, when we get down in verses 12 through 15, this is really written mostly as a summary after a defeat of the gathered kings. And in verse 12, what we see is the restatement, and this is very common in the way that things were written in this era. You might hear the story three times in the same chapter, one going into it, one in some of the details, and then at the end, the really important things, and maybe even more details. In this case, it goes back and it says, all the cities of these kings were captured and utterly destroyed. And one of these phrases keeps coming up over and over and over again, and it's a very important phrase. But this one's a little different. The phrase that we see over and over again, just as Yahweh commanded. But in this case, it isn't taking away from Yahweh, but he's saying, just as Moses commanded. So Joshua is carrying out the instructions that if we go clear back and talk about the Moses direction, what was his writing, what was his direction to them? When you take the land, don't make treaties, destroy the people, leave none alive. And this is part of the book of the law that Moses wrote. That's what we read in the book of Numbers. And so Joshua was told early in the book of Joshua, this book of the law shall not depart from your mouth, but you shall meditate on it day and night. We talked about the fact, depart from your mouth. Part of his instructions to the people was to be continually out of the book of the law that Moses wrote. And so here is Joshua doing just as commanded, just as directed both by Moses and by Yahweh himself. He's following the book of the law. He's doing just as Moses commanded. And it goes on to give us a little more detail. The only city that was burned out of this northern conquest was Hazar. In the rest of the place, they took spoil, livestock, and other plunder, but no breathing person was left. And in verse 15, we also see the transition that's occurred, that Moses is gone, but in verse 15 it says, Moses was commanded by Yahweh, and Joshua likewise. In similar manner to the way that Moses was commanded, Joshua is being commanded. And Joshua has left nothing undone of what was commanded to all, commanded to and by Moses in his direction and in his writing. Comments. Just a little bit there, okay? So we start a transition in the book of Joshua now, but this is kind of a broader summary in verses 16 through 23. So let's take a look at Joshua 11, 16 through 23. Get my page to turn here. So this is another summary of the conquest as a whole. And it says, thus Joshua took all that land, the hill country and all the Negev, and all the land of Goshen, the lowland, the Arabah, the hill country of Israel and its lowland, from Mount Halak that rises toward Seir, even as far as Baal-Gad in the valley of Lebanon at the foot of Mount Hermon. And he captured all their kings, and he struck them down and put them to death. Joshua waged war a long time with all these kings. There was not a city which made peace with the sons of Israel except the Hivites living in Gibeon. They took them all in battle. For it was of the Lord to harden their hearts and to meet Israel in battle in order that he might utterly destroy them, that they might receive no mercy, but that he might destroy them just as the Lord had commanded Moses. Then Joshua came at that time and cut off the Anakim from the hill country, from Hebron, from Debir, from Anab, and from all the hill country of Judah, and from all the hill country of Israel. Joshua utterly destroyed them with and their cities. There were no Anakim left in the land of the sons of Israel, only in Gaza, in Gath, at Ashdod, some remained. So Joshua took the whole land according to all that the Lord had spoken to Moses, and Joshua gave it for inheritance to Israel according to the divisions by their tribes. Thus the land had rest from the war. So in this summary, we see that Joshua took all the land. There weren't things left principally undone. And it goes from the hill country, the Negev, which we know is very much south, the land of Goshen, probably over there between Gaza and Gibeon, the lowlands or foothills between Mad and Judah, the Arabah, this is from the Dead Sea to the Red Sea, that region, and the hill country of Israel and the lowland. We've got a hill country in the north and a hill country in the south, and he took it all. And verse 18 lets us in on the fact this is a bit of a summary. Joshua waged war a long time. So when we get to this summary, we're not talking about these daily quick skirmishes. This was an ongoing series of battles. Let's go over and look at Deuteronomy chapter 7, verses 20 through 24. Deuteronomy 7, 20 through 24. This is prophecy about what the Lord is going to do regarding this. This is a whole last half of chapter 7 is promises of God about what's going to come about as they follow him. But beginning here in verse 20, moreover, the Lord your God will send the hornet against them until those who are left and hide themselves from you perish. You shall not dread them, for the Lord your God is in your midst, a great and awesome God. The Lord your God will clear away these nations before you little by little. You will not be able to put an end to them quickly, for the wild beasts would grow too numerous for you. But the Lord your God will deliver them before you and will throw them into great confusion until they are destroyed. He will deliver their kings into your hand so that you will make their name perish from under the heaven. No man will be able to stand before you until you have destroyed them. And this is God's direction or information about how he's going to push them out. Yes, there were some early quick victories and they found cities to live in as a result. But God says, I'm going to send a hornet, the armies out there represented by these hornets. But we're going to clear these out, but we're going to do it little by little. And if you looked at the passage, God gave a good reason why. Why would he decide, or why did he direct, inform them it would be little by little? There's a reason and a logic for it, and God told it. What was it? Yeah. If you had if you just completely wiped everybody out, the time it would take you to settle and so on, by the time you got back to some of those communities, they would be overgrown. It has amazed me as I have seen more years come upon my frame, how quickly properties, buildings, equipment goes away, becomes worthless, is degraded to the point of not even almost being usable when it's left unused and unattended by men who would keep it up. And so what God is saying here is we need to take it as we're going to use it. If we take it and then abandon it, if you will, for a period of time, it's not going to be well cared for and used for and usable when you get there. And so this is what God said would happen. The best estimate is this was about 7 years of war that's mentioned here in verse 18, as Joshua kept clearing out city by city, expanding the areas that they were in. And the account says that there were no survivors except for who? Well, the Hivites, which are Amorites, which are descendants of Canaan. All that's left are the Hivites and Gibeon, because they made peace with Israel. And in verse 20, we see that when they would come upon a city, God directed them, when you get toward the edges, you go to them, and if they want to make peace, you can make peace with them. But if it's beyond the normal borders, you give them that chance, but if they won't, then you destroy them. And no city chose to make peace. Why? What does the text tell us why? God hardened their hearts. Does that mean that God forced them necessarily, forced them into a position they wouldn't normally have taken? That they really didn't have in their hearts? No. They didn't have plans to support Yahweh and be friends with Israel, and God hardened their position, and they answered out of those hard hearts that they would not make peace with Israel, and so Joshua was defeating them all. No peace treaties made. Now, Joshua 21 starts an interesting section. And it says, Joshua cut off Anakim from the hill country, including Hebron, Debir, Anab, and all the hill country of Judea and Israel. He utterly destroyed them and their cities. No Anakim was left in Israel, only in Gaza, Gath, and Asherod. There were some that remained. And so who were the Anakim? Who is it that Joshua is cutting off and destroying? You know? Go over to Numbers chapter 13. Numbers chapter 13. And we're going to start in verse 38. Now, this is another recounting, or is the accounting of the spies seeking out the land. Clear back the time that it resulted in them being kept from entering the promised land. So beginning in verse 28, I'm going to read through 33. Nevertheless, the people who live in the land are strong, and the cities are fortified and very large. And moreover, we saw the descendants of Anak there. Amalek is living in the land of the Negev, and the Hittites and the Jebusites and the Amorites are living in the hill country, and the Canaanites are living by the sea and by the side of the Jordan. Then Caleb quieted the people before Moses and said, "We should by all means go up and take possession of it, for we will surely overcome it." But the men who had gone up with him said, "We are not able to go up against the people, for they are too strong for us." So they gave out to the sons of Israel a bad report of the land, which they spied out, saying, "The land through which we have gone through in spying it out is a land that devours its inhabitants, and all the people whom we saw are in it are men of great size. There also we saw the Nephilim, the sons of Anak, are part of the Nephilim. And we became like grasshoppers in our own sight, and we were in their sight." Now, that comment about the sons of Anak being part of the Nephilim is not in all texts, but these are definitely the descendants of Anak. And the descendants of Anak, that word Anak means long-necked. And so these are the people that were the family group that the spies had seen, in all probability, that they said, "They're like giants. They're huge. We're grasshoppers in their sight." And this is a territory that will later be given to Caleb as a reward for his loyalty. We're going to get over to that in chapter 14 of Joshua. But in our passage here in Joshua today, we see that they remained in Gath. Well, Gath is the homeland for the Philistines later on, and it's likely that that Goliath was a descendant of Anak as well, and one of these men. So Joshua is cutting them off and isolating them. And in verse 23, he said, "He took the whole land." And an important phrase in verse 23, "according to all that Yahweh spoke to Moses." And then Joshua gave as an inheritance to Israel this land, which would be divided by tribes, and the land had rest from war. What a moment that would be. We can only imagine, most of us, due to age, but what it was like when some of the great wars ended in the recent past. And the readiness to be at peace and not be fighting, and all of the death and destruction continuing. And so here they were after a period of 7+ years, and Joshua's fighting and taking the land that they could have rest and peace. Comments, thoughts? Okay. Well, let's turn the page. We're in a section now where the way that I'm going to cover these is going to be a little bit different. And so let's just do chapter 12 today, and I'll show you why and what that means. I'm going to begin in chapter 12 by reading the first 6 verses. "Now these are the kings of the land whom the sons of Israel defeated, and whose land they possessed beyond the Jordan toward the sunrise, from the valley of Arnon as far as Mount Hermon, and all of Arabah to the east. Sihon, king of the Amorites, who lived in Heshbon and ruled over Aor, which is the edge of the valley of the Arnon, both in the middle of the valley and half of Gilead, as far as the brook of Jabbok, the border of the sons of Ammon. And the Arabah, as far as the sea of Chinneroth toward the east, and as far as the sea of the Arabah, even the salt sea, eastward toward Beth Jeshimoth, and the south at the foot of the slopes of Pisgah. And the territory of Og, king of Bashan, of the remnant of Rephaim, who lived at Ashtaroth and at Edrei, and ruled over Mount Hermon and Salcah, and all the Bashan, as far as the border of the Geshurites and the Maacathites, and half of Gilead, as far as the border of Sihon, king of Heshbon. Moses, the servant of the Lord, and the sons of Israel defeated them, and Moses and the servant of the Lord gave it to the Reubenites and the Gadites and the half-tribe of Manasseh as a possession. So in the first verse, it says, now these are the kings of the land who the sons of Israel defeated, the land they possessed beyond the Jordan toward the sunrise from the valley of Arnon, and it goes on to describe it. What's the direction of the sunrise? And so these verses we just read are primarily focused on the lands that were taken and the kings defeated east of the Jordan. And it begins a description of all their conquests and the things that they took. And these first six verses are the kings that were defeated by who, did it say?
Moses.
So this is the land that was taken before they crossed the Jordan and began the conquest of Canaanite, the promised land. This is for the tribes that the agreement was made with the Reubenites, the Gadites, and half of Manasseh. Yes, you can settle here. It fits you well. You like it. You want to be here. But when we go west of the Jordan, you've got to go along. All of your fighting men have to go. And so this is a recounting of what they did east of the Jordan and all of this, a great quantity of land that they captured pretty easily from Sihon and Og, Amorite kings, there east of the Jordan. Thoughts? I mean, that's pretty much what those first six verses talked about. So let me go ahead and look at verses 7 and 8, and then I'm going to skip down to verse 24, and I think you'll see why I do it that way. So here's 7 and 8. Now these are the kings of the land whom Joshua and the sons of Israel defeated beyond the Jordan toward the west, from Baal-gad in the valley of Lebanon as far as Mount Halak, which rises toward Seir. And Joshua gave it to the tribes of Israel as a possession according to their divisions. In the hill country, in the lowland of Arabah, and on the slopes, and in the wilderness, in the Negev, the Hittite, the Amorite, the Canaanite, the Perizzite, the Hivite, and the Jebusite. And then in verse 9, it starts listing the kings. King of Jericho 1, king of Ai, which is beside Bethel 1, and it keeps on going, listing the kings that Joshua defeated. Let's go down and look at verse 24. And it lists the last king in this list, the king of Tirzah 1, in all 31 kings. When we read that list, and I understand that we could spend a lot of time trying to figure out who and where all these kings were. But the bottom line is there's 31 kings here that Joshua defeated in the course of taking the land. And so in this chapter, I'm not going to go through each and every one of those, but it shows the 31 kings and the 31 plus probably cities that were involved with that, because some of them, as we were reading previously, cities were in plural. And so this is an accounting here in chapter 12 that would be definitely a part of their history that would be important, but when we read through those, they don't have the connections for us. Some of them probably are nebulous beyond figuring out even. And so I'm not planning to take the time to go through and figure all of those kings out one by one. And that's pretty much what I intend to cover for chapter 12. Questions, comments, suggestions? It's easy when we get to the summary chapters. It's easy for me when I think about teaching it to minimize what happened here. And I certainly don't want to lead us into that kind of thinking. This is a mammoth miracle that God would lead Joshua And that even as God leads Joshua, it all lines up with the words and directions given to Moses that he wrote down in the book of the law. And that Joshua then recaptures when they build the altar. Lost the name of the mountain. As they come into the promised land, right after they take Ai. I mean, all of these things are done, and it lines up with the power of God leading Joshua through it. The communication between God and Joshua, where God gave him encouraging comments at the right time. Don't be afraid, I've given you these people. And it still lines up with exactly what God told the people of Israel through Moses and the directions given. When you get in the promised land, do these things. And even the statement that is said in our at the end of chapter 12, I'm sorry, end of chapter 11, that all that was directed was done by Joshua and nothing was left undone based on those directions. Living a life with nothing left done that God commanded us or directed us to do through His Word, through the Holy Spirit, is an amazing thing. And we ought not lose sight of that. Any other thoughts from you today? All right, we'll pick it up with chapter 13 next time.